Good morning.
Anytime we get together to sing, to worship the Lord, we think of what we just sung in terms of our hand reaching up to Jesus, His hand reaching down to ours. Hand in hand with Jesus, we walk each day. And that is a good opportunity and an outstanding privilege for us as Christians. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. There was once a man named Solomon. He was made king over Israel. He had all the riches and the honor. He had all the wisdom and all the understanding that man could have. These things were given to the Lord by him. As a matter of fact, it was given to such a degree that his wisdom and understanding exceeded all of those who were of his day. And I believe the same is true today in the sense that his wisdom was outstanding and would be excelling all of us who are here today as well. With so much going for him then, do you think that he would be an outstanding example for us to consider with the topic we're going to talk about today? Maybe the answer is yes. Maybe the answer is no, depending on how you may look at it. What we're going to be talking about today involves, of course, our overall topic of secularism in the church. It involves the lost principles, the lost virtues, if you will, of time, past and present. And our topic in particular is learning, understanding, and optimism. Some of you may ask, why, if we're going to talk about secularism in the church, why would you go back and talk about a man who lived 3,000 years ago? Why go back and talk about Solomon to talk about secularism in the church today? And I believe that the answer lies in the fact that there are many parallels that we can think about with Solomon, with secularism in his life, and with the idea of it being so in the church today as well. We begin then with the idea of secularism. Secularism, basically, when we speak of that, essentially means worldly influence. Another aspect may be something that is non-spiritual. So what we're really talking about then is warning ourselves and the church against worldly influence within the church. The worldly influence of the church begins with the individual. In other words, as Satan or sin affect me, that brings secularism into the church. As sin or Satan affect you, the same happens. That is an aspect of secularism or worldly influence in the church. When we think of Solomon, while God gave him a lot of wisdom, did he fall prey to that same thing? Satan and sin entering his life and secularism, if you will, followed. With this, we understand, most believe and accept that Solomon was the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes. It so happens that one of the Bible studies I'm involved in now, we are studying the book of Ecclesiastes. So as I sat down to begin this lesson, this is a passage or this is a book that came to my mind. Now, what I want to do is establish with you for a moment, we're going to spend some time today in the book of Ecclesiastes. But before we do that, what I want to do is I want to make some connections between Ecclesiastes and the church. Secularism in the church, secularism shown in Ecclesiastes, in essence, is what we find. Ecclesiastes is from a Hebrew word, and I'm going to pronounce it English-wise, the way it looks to me at least, Koheleth. Okay? That word means preacher. Another aspect of it involves an assembly. So it would be similar to a preacher preaching to an assembly of God's people. Now, what about the church? The church is from the Greek word ekklesia, which also we find is the called out of God or an assembly. So we find a connection between the two. Both Ecclesiastes and ekklesia, or the church, relate to the assembly of God's people. They both, in a sense, also relate to preaching within that assembly. And so when we think of Solomon and we think of Ecclesiastes, something to remember is these words that Solomon preached, while they were written or spoken 3,000 years ago, they were spoken to an assembly of God's people, in a sense. And that assembly is just as our assembly today is very much a part of what we might call the great congregation of God's people, the church of all ages, the church of the time of Solomon, if you will, and the church or the ecclesia of today. So Ecclesiastes, ecclesia, there is a connection. And so as we listened to some of the words of Solomon with in regard to learning, understanding, and optimism, think about what Solomon says and think about how it applies to us today. I've begun with Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 2, where it said, "Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Go with me, if you will, to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. I'm going to read a few passages. We're going to begin with verse 12 through 14. "I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind." Verses 16 through 18. "I communed with my heart, saying, Look, I have attained greatness. I have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is grasping for the wind, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow." So think about this with me and follow through with me, if you will. Here in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, basically we find in verses 12 through 18, Solomon describes his quest for wisdom and the vanity of it. In chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, he describes the fact that he sought after worldly pleasure. Verse 3 in particular speaks about how he searched my heart, how to gratify my flesh with wine. And of course, he found that was also futile. In verses 4 through 6, we find that he seeks after arts, after agriculture. Just kind of glancing through. "I made my works great. I built houses. I planted vineyards, gardens, fruit trees, pools. And yet, what happened? He found it to be vanity." And we go into verses 7 through 11, where we have, he speaks of his great possessions, male and female servants. He goes on and speaks about the possessions of his herds and flocks. He goes into verse 8, speaking about silver and gold. He continues to speak about the instruments of music. He tried to find pleasure in those. Verses 9 through 11, I will read directly. "So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun." Go a few verses later to verse 17. "Therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind." So let's stop and consider what we've found. Here is Solomon, a man who had it all, right? He had all wisdom and understanding. He had all riches and all power. So in terms of him seeking for learning, understanding, and optimism, you would think he would be on the right track to start with, wouldn't you? Now, we've seen the results of some of the things he found, but on the surface, people of his time probably thought, he has it made. He's doing great with all this. But what he realized as he sought for those things is he realized the vanity of them. Did he not? And with that, then, with this emptiness, he also saw that he was not optimistic. What did verse 17 say? "Therefore I what? I hated life." So with all that was going for him, with this great optimism that many people would think would be available to someone in that position, it wasn't there. In reality, his optimism, he was as far from optimistic as the East is from the West, as another passage in the Bible speaks of. I want to continue on with a few more verses. We recognize that Solomon, in his struggles, also did have some godly things to say, and I believe certainly by the time he wrote this and in later life did turn back to God again. Naturally, we understand that it seems early in his life he was fully after God. He became distracted as he sought for learning and understanding, but then he recognized that it is in the Lord. Listen to a few other verses, and you'll see some positives that are brought out as well. In chapter 3, let's look at verses 9 through 15. What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task which the sons of men are to be occupied. Notice that key phrase there in verse 10. He has seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. Verse 11, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts. And I think that relates to this God-given purpose, this God-given task, relating to the fact that God has put eternity in our hearts. Except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. God does it. That men should fear before him. That which is, has already been, and what is to be, has already been. And God requires an account of what is past. Chapter 5, verse 1. Walk prudently when you go to the house of God, and draw near to hear, rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. I truly appreciate especially that phrase, when we come to the house of God to draw near to hear. Of course, that's done in our own homes as we study God's word as well. We draw near to hear. Chapter 6, verse 7. All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. And now go with me to chapter 12. It's good if we're going to point out some of the negative, positive conclusions Solomon reaches after seeking things in a negative way. But of course, we want to come back to the idea that where Solomon eventually ended, and that is Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 1. Remember now your Creator in the days of your youth, before the difficult days come, and the years draw nigh when you say, I have no pleasure in them. And then down to verses 13 and 14. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. Secularism in the church, secularism in the life of Solomon. As we've looked through this, we've seen the worldly influence that it had, the influence that the world had on Solomon. We've seen, in terms of seeking for happiness, if you will, seeking for learning and understanding, the end where he came. Now, if we step back and we think about applying that to us today, how many people have we known or you known in life, and how many people do you think, since the time of Solomon, have sought to follow his pattern? How many have said, I need to find out about learning and understanding? How many in doing this have ended up turning from the Lord? How many think that they are smart enough on their own, and things of the gospel and things of God are maybe too simple, or they need to go out and find something a little different? Many would reach Solomon's conclusion that it's vanity. Some may never reach that conclusion. But we know that this has happened often. And that is certainly an example of secularism, the worldly influence coming into the church. Anytime someone does that, anytime someone falls away
as well.
There's many things for us to appreciate and consider with this. What I'd like to do next is I'd like to use what we've kind of considered with the first half of this lesson in regard to Solomon. I'm going to move into the second half of this in terms of learning and understanding. I'm going to mention three areas. First, we're going to talk a little about schools, education. We're going to talk about television programming and books that are available, that are very prominent in the religious world today, that have very little biblical basis. And we're going to talk also about strong, truly spiritual learning and understanding. So to talk about learning and understanding, one of the first places to think of or to consider are schools. All of us receive education in some way, whether we are now very young, where we're being taught things at home by our parents, whether we are older in years, we've received some type of education. I'm going to make just a couple of very brief comments about public schools, first on the positive side and then also on the negative. On the positive side regarding public schools, education, which is where people would follow this avenue, this pursuit of learning and understanding. On the positive side, there is much good that has been accomplished and is still being accomplished by public schools across America and across the world. Reading, writing, math, history, literature, fine arts, all of these are valuable in their place, in their situation. Social aspects, friendships, interactions with others, all of these are valuable, a part of the learning process. Much of what is learned in public schools is beneficial and is profitable in life. And I would hope what I'm trying to do is take a balanced approach, and even for those who may not be particularly excited about the public school system, hopefully you also would agree that there are positives to be found as well. Let's consider for a moment negatives in public schools as well, because we certainly need to consider that. There's a lot to be concerned about and to be on guard when it comes to public schools. From the time a person enters kindergarten, by the time they've graduated from the 12th grade, their senior year, as they continue on into college, for those who do that, will they be exposed to many teachings that oppose the Bible? Will they be exposed to many peers who are anything but righteous toward the Lord? Will they be exposed to situations which bring temptation and sin? And the answer to all of these is yes, they will. As grandparents, as parents, and as young people going through that particular experience, what do we need to do to equip you, and what do you need to do to equip yourself? Do you need to be very, very strongly equipped to face these things? Do you need to have a very strong determination and dedication in your heart to know what you believe, to know why you believe it, and to be able to withstand those who would teach otherwise? Yes. What we need to do is we need to be strong with this. We need to recognize both the positives and the negatives that are there. I also might make one or two statements about homeschooling. Due to these negative influences in the public schools, many Christian parents make the decision to homeschool their parents, to homeschool their children. Their reasoning with this would be that as they homeschool, they are then being able to reduce this secularism within their family, this worldly influence within their children, and in turn, does that reduce the worldly influence within the church? And I think the answer would be yes. So parents who make this choice should be commended in what they're doing and should be supported in their efforts. This certainly is not a matter of public school, private school, homeschool, one way or the other. What it is an acknowledging of both. I think people can go either direction, and as children become adults, graduate from these situations, we can have strong Christians, whether homeschooled or in public schools. But having said that, I also think it would be wise to conclude this particular section by making a couple of more very strong statements about being on guard against things from public schools as well. Not at all a matter of slamming with this, but we are talking about secularism in the church, and so We need to focus on that aspect for a moment. What we find is that there are many dangers that are present, some specific ones that we typically think of, evolution being taught opposed to the Bible, premarital sex being at least supported opposed to the Bible, homosexuality being at least supported in the sense that all beliefs are typically viewed how in today's world, including in the public schools. All beliefs are considered to be equally valid. I'm not saying I do, and I'm not saying you do, but that's the general consensus now in many places, that you can believe the way you want, I'll believe the way I want. We're all equal with this. But what we need to do is we need to establish that while this may be man's philosophy, it is not God's teaching. And therefore, as we, and as that mentality creeps into our own thinking system or into the church, these are examples of how secularism does invade the church. So a couple of examples in relation to that. When we compromise our beliefs, or when we compromise our morals individually, what we're talking about for a moment, that is secularism in the church. When that also becomes something that is then taught publicly, either from the pulpit, in sermons or class, whatever the case may be, then that would be another aspect, another level, if you will. If we're honest with ourselves, has that already occurred to a degree? Probably so. Will it be even more so 10 and 20 years from now? Probably so. We need to be on guard, and we need to be prepared to allow that to happen as little as possible. Let's move from that, continuing with that, but moving a little further. Again, we're still talking about learning and understanding, and I think schools are certainly one place that happens and a good point to address. A second area that I want to address for a moment deals with people who, in a sense, want to combine the learning and understanding of man with spiritual things. And what I have in mind with that is we can turn on the television today and we can see much television broadcasting, or we can go to our local bookstore and see many books where there are degrees of spirituality taught. But many of those books also do not include a real biblical basis. Now, having said that, are there a lot of good broadcasts, radio-wise, television-wise? Are there very good books that are written that are very scripturally based? And I think the answer is yes. But we also recognize that there are also many that have truly very little value. What that does, in a sense, is it seems to fit our American lifestyle pretty well. Because in general, if we were to consider, do most Americans have at least some level of desire to learn and to understand spiritual things? I think most Americans have at least some level of desire for that. About a year ago, I was reading through something where I ran across a particular quote. If I remember right, this was in a Gallup survey about religion in America, and there was a particular quote that stuck with me, and that is that religion in America is about a mile long and an inch deep. Now, if we stop and think about that for a moment, religion being about a mile long and an inch deep, that's really what this section is talking about. Guarding against lessons that we may hear, guarding against books that we may read that have a degree of spirituality, because truly, as the name of God brought out many, many times, is a degree of spirituality mentioned very often in books and television broadcasts? The answer is yes. But if you really stop and get into it, often it's about an inch deep. It's very wide, but doesn't involve a whole lot. And therein lies the danger. Much around us invokes God's name and His spirituality, but in reality, we've got to become deeper. The message of man appeals to the senses. The message of God appeals to the soul. And really, that's what we have. The message that I'm talking about there would be a message that would appeal to the senses. The message of God appeals to the soul. But what happens is often many are then lulled to sleep. They're lulled to complacency by looking to these authors and these speakers as outstanding religious leaders, and then base their religious and spiritual beliefs and understandings on their interpretations and motivational comments rather than true biblical perspectives. The standard and aim of spiritual understanding and learning has been shifted from the Bible and the soul to motivational pep talks appealing to the senses. With this, we find that optimism produced by one is but for the moment. Optimism produced by the Bible and for the soul is for eternity. Let me just mention that once again, speaking there about optimism. Optimism produced by the one method that we've been speaking of is but for the moment, through the senses. Optimism from the Bible and for the soul is for eternity. And that's what we base our optimism on, if you will. And let's move to the last area that I'll choose with this, and that is strong, truly spiritual learning and understanding. In a sense, what we're doing is we're moving our lesson to the point of bringing in John's, when he will talk in the second half of our service this morning, about faith in God and the Bible. I've certainly tried to include that and imply it, but I haven't got in depth into that piece of it, because that's John's topic. But what we find in terms of strong spiritual learning and understanding, I think of Matthew chapter 5, verse 6. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after what?
Righteousness,
for they shall be filled. Learning and understanding is about hungering and thirsting. How many here this morning are hungry or thirsty? Hungering and thirsting after righteousness. You know, I might ask the question, have we lost sight of spiritual learning and understanding? Have we lost sight of hungering and thirsting? I might for a moment compare this or bring out a point and then compare it to something. The point I would bring out is prosperity and affluence. What is or are disadvantages of prosperity and affluence? Do they bring on a sense of complacency? If people are not prosperous or affluent, what we would hope at least is they would be out working their tail off, doing anything and everything they could. Every penny they earned, they would appreciate. And if we think about American society, there was a time when American society was not as prosperous or affluent, and there was more of an appreciation for certain things. Now, as we've moved into more prosperity and affluence, our work ethic and drive to excel has, I would say, been diminished some. This doesn't mean each individual. I'm not talking about each individual here, but I think in general that's a true concept. And if we want to go to others to consider that, if you were to go to schools and talk to teachers, if you were to go to employers who hire people, would they find that there is a difficulty in motivating people today, motivating students to succeed, motivating employees to excel to their best level? And I think, I mean, I've read many articles. I've been there as well in the school side. There is concern there, and it is challenging to bring that motivation out of people. Does that affect the church? And we would be pulling the wool over our eyes if we said that it hasn't or it doesn't. Because I think as long as we are human, there are times that we will become complacent. And that to me is one of the core messages that would come from a lesson such as this. Losing that virtue of learning and understanding. Losing that virtue of optimism, if you will. Certainly, again, not saying that we all have, or even that the majority of us have, but I think our tendency would be to have lost it some. So what is the solution? Where does the solution begin? It begins with me. And as you make that statement, you're saying the same thing, which means that it begins with you. It begins with you to continue to improve and increase your commitment. your dedication, your hunger and thirst after righteousness, to increase and improve your learning and understanding, seeking it fully after God's will. Have you heard the phrase, learn it, love it, and live it? Probably you've heard the phrase. Apply that to our topic today. Apply that to learning and understanding. Apply that to hungering and thirsting after righteousness. Learn it, love it, and live it. May we do this. We think, and we're talking now kind of about the solution to this, we consider Colossians chapter 3. How does that begin? If you then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your affection on things above, not on things of the earth. So this morning, as we've taken the opportunity to speak about learning, understanding, and optimism, we've used the example of Solomon, and hopefully we've made the point that there are two areas with Solomon. It came in individually. As it came in individually with him, it affected the church. There was also the aspect of the Ecclesiastes, preacher, assembly, connecting that with the church, and that message being very important for us today as well. We've considered it in terms of schools, education from that side. We've considered it in terms of the religious or spiritual environment and kind of a watering down that might happen. And we've considered it in terms of each of us being challenged to increase and improve ourselves with this as well. What I might conclude with comes from a line by a man named Thomas Jefferson that many of you know. It's going to be very familiar with you. Thomas Jefferson, in writing the Declaration of Independence, I don't believe he initiated or originated this phrase, but he said that all men were created with certain inalienable rights, that among those were life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Right? We remember Solomon's words in Ecclesiastes 12, 13 and 14, where he said, "Hear the conclusion of the whole matter, fear God and keep His commandments," and so on. I'm not going to reword Solomon's advice and conclusion, but I think another way that we could also say something similar in terms of learning, understanding, and wisdom, in terms of the pursuit of happiness, what I would encourage us all to do is to understand that the pursuit of happiness is through the pursuit of righteousness.